Hello, and welcome to the Power Aqua podcast, a science podcast that shines a light on the newest and most interesting research being conducted in the fields of aquatic and marine ecology. My name is Joe Money. I'm a PhD student and the host of this podcast. Today, I'm joined by Professor Tristy Vic Majors, who is a professor of biological sciences at Michigan Technological University, located in Houghton in the United States. We'll be discussing her research into subglacial microbial ecology and her sampling expeditions to Antarctica and the Alaskan Arctic. Tristy, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Joe. Thanks. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad. It's finally getting warm here in Poznan. How are things in Michigan?
Not too bad. I mean, I think it's officially spring. No more snow. I mean, it could still snow, but right now it's melted and it's just kind of rainy.
Well, that's good that it's slowly getting into spring for you. That's great. So Tristy, can you give us a quick summary of your background, your education, and maybe a bit about your research history?
Yeah, sure. So I actually grew up in a very small town in eastern Colorado in the United States. So I lived in an area called the High Plains. You could just barely see the tops of the Rocky Mountains from where I lived. So for
Nice.
anyone who's familiar with the Western US, that gives some context. I grew up in a small town. And I was actually really interested in writing when I was young. I did not think that I would be a scientist. When I went to college to do my bachelor's degree, I actually started out as a psychology major.
Oh, wow.
So I was really interested in psychology and I was really interested in creative writing. But as I started taking more classes and getting involved in more things, I realized that I really cared about the environment. And I really cared about trying to make the world a better place, which sounds probably very simplistic, right? But as a college freshman, that was a big realization for me. And I decided that the only way that I could do that was by really understanding the world around me. So I decided to major in biology. I got interested in studying microorganisms and understanding how life can survive in different types of environments. After college, I worked for a little while in unrelated fields, trying to decide what I wanted to do in graduate school. Took a few years off. I initially returned to graduate school with the plan of studying extremophiles living in hot springs. So I did that for a little while. But through that, I was introduced to an Antarctic scientist named John Priskiw at Montana State University. And I decided to join his lab after having the opportunity to work with them for an Antarctic field season. So I did my master's degree at Montana State University, focusing on microbial ecology in Antarctic surface lakes in an area called the Dry Valleys. From there, that's how my career started.
Wow, that's quite a journey from psychology to microbial ecology. And I particularly like that you've started with extreme heat environments and now going to extreme cold environments. That's quite a U-turn, but I guess in some ways they're actually very similar.
I mean, I think it's amazing the ways in which life can survive in different environments. And I also think it's really interesting how we can study those environments in different ways to maybe better understand where life came from and how it evolved. And how it might persist in other places in the solar system as well. So my interests in that are kind of broad.
Yeah, that's a really good point that it can tell us so much more about life, you know, at the beginnings of the planet, the beginnings of the formation of the continents and the seas and stuff like that. I think that's a really interesting point. Now, lakes might not be the first thing that comes to mind when you think of the frozen, windswept landscapes of the polar regions. Could you describe what a polar or even a subglacial lake is and how they are able to form in one of the coldest places in the world?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. And when I talk to people about Antarctica, that's one of the points that I like to make is that, people, if they have thought about Antarctica at all, which they may not have, they tend to view it as this really harsh environment where there's not much life or there's no life at all. They think of it as being just ice and nothing else. And so I like to make the point that Antarctica is really diverse. So you have this continent, which is a land mass, right? It's covered mostly by ice, and it's surrounded by the ocean. So the marine environment, of course, has lots of life, and people are used to thinking about things maybe like penguins and seals, and whales that live in the Antarctic Ocean. But when you move on to the continent itself, you have small areas that are free of ice. So these are places like the dry valleys where I mentioned that I did my master's work. In these dry valley areas, you have these regions that are basically like glacially carved valleys where the ice has receded. You have a valley system that's surrounded by mountain glaciers. And these mountain glaciers, in many cases, feed lakes on the valley floors. These lakes tend to not have outlets, so their water balance is maintained by the formation of ice on the lake surface, and then the loss of ice, which is mainly through ablation, so wind action, that takes place primarily during the winter. So these liquid water columns are maintained because they pull in enough heat from the summer sun that actually transmits through the thick ice covers, which in some cases are 5 meters thick, maybe more, depending on where you're looking. And these systems are really, really great places to study microbial life. So that's one type of lake in the Antarctic. The other type of lake that I've worked on, which I focused on for my PhD and have focused on in other work since then, is subglacial lakes. And these lakes, we know now that there are around, I think we're up to a count of about 600 of them that are underneath the Antarctic ice sheet. So they're underneath anywhere between, I don't know, half a kilometer and 3 kilometers of ice. And they are maintained as liquid water environments, essentially because of the pressure of the ice sheet above them and then the heat coming up from the Earth's surface below. So these lakes persist over time underneath this very, very thick ice cover, and they're really great places to look for life.
Yeah, that's incredible to think that under so much ice there can be water sort of accumulated in e even in a puddle, let alone a lake. And actually, I didn't quite realize that actually the Earth's surface temperature was a factor in the formation of liquid water. That's very interesting. I wouldn't have thought there would have been enough heat, but I mean, I don't know much about the subject.
Yeah, there's just enough geothermal heat flux coming up from below. But really the key thing is that pressure from the ice above, because that changes the freezing point of the water. Kind of similar to what happens in marine systems, where water doesn't freeze in the Southern Ocean when it's 2 degrees below Celsius, because of salinity. In these subglacial lakes, it's a similar idea. It's just due to pressure instead of salinity.
That's another really important factor, I guess. So you have had extensive experience sampling these subglacial lakes. Would you tell us a bit about how you are able to sample these incredibly inaccessible lakes and what you're hoping to find?
Yeah. So I think the technological aspects of sampling these lakes is something that's really, really interesting and a bit complex. There are some really cool engineering problems involved in it. We kind of start from a point of saying, okay, we need to get samples from these lakes, but they're locked under all of this ice, which is a challenge. But it also means that they're really insulated from human influence, right? They're not contaminated by outside processes, and we want to keep them that way. So, historically, most ice drilling methods have been developed for the collection of ice cores. They're used to answer questions about climate and things like that. But those technologies rely on drilling fluids, which are usually hydrocarbon-based. They use things similar to kerosene, and they do that partly so that the drills that they're using don't freeze into the ice because the ice is about minus 40 degrees Celsius. They also add that so that the boreholes don't collapse on themselves. It keeps them from freezing shut. When we're talking about a subglacial lake, we don't want to add kerosene to our hole because then that might end up in the lake and that's a contaminant. So instead of doing that, we have used a hot water drilling system where we collect snow from the surrounding environment, put it in a big melt tank, and then run it through a system of heaters, which in kind of a funny aside, are actually rebuilt from car washes, so like a place that you would drive your car into
Wow.
to have the pressurized water spray it down and clean your vehicle. Some really smart engineers took those systems and modified them to heat and pressurize our drill water. So we use that. We run the water through a series of filter banks and through a series of ultraviolet light banks. And the combination of those filters out particles and microbial cells. It also kills microbial cells by virtue of the ultraviolet light and destroys organic matter that could be introduced into the lake. So our sampling is really dependent on these large hot water drill systems to allow us to access the lakes cleanly.
Wow, that sounds like such a technological challenge to drill so far through kilometers of ice and do it so well and so precisely that you're not even, introducing any human made molecules, I guess. It's really incredible.
Yeah, that's the goal. And we, in addition to using that technology, we also use the, I guess you would say, the pressure from the ice itself to our advantage. So we do things like we control the amount of drilling water that's sitting in our borehole, so that when the lake is entered, lake water rushes up into the borehole instead of drilling water flushing down into the borehole. So there are kind of simpler ways that you can help the situation, but we really want to make sure that what we're putting near the lake is clean.
Yeah, and once you've got to the lake, which is, sounds like a really difficult challenge, what samples are you taking, and what specifically are you looking for down there?
Yeah, so I mean, the first time that we did this, which was in 2013, no one had drilled directly into a subglacial lake at that point in time. And so our first goal was really just to show that there was life there. And we wanted to show that in three different ways. So we chose three ways of both looking for microbial cells under the microscope. So we took a microscope into the field, brought some water up, put it under the scope, and looked for bacterial cells, which we saw, which was pretty exciting.
Yeah, massive finding.
And then we measured their activity in a couple of different ways to show that they were actually doing something under the ice and not just sitting there. So that was kind of the first main goal. But since that goal has been achieved, now we're moving on to other questions like how did they survive under the ice? We are interested in looking more deeply into their genomes. To understand their adaptations, and perhaps how far they have diverged from life, on the surface of the planet.
Yeah, that's such an incredibly isolated environment. It sounds like a really pioneering expedition that you're a part of, and it's very impressive, very cool.
It's a great opportunity.
Given your extensive experience, could you give us a sense of what it's like working at a polar scientific base and what it's like attempting to collect data under these extreme conditions? It must be very difficult for scientists and engineers, I would imagine.
Yeah, that's a good question too. When we go down on these sampling campaigns, we initially are based out of McMurdo Station, which is the US Antarctic Program's kind of main operations base. And that's a pretty large station. It can get up to around 1,000 people on base, doing all kinds of different science and all kinds of support tasks that without which the science would not be possible. That's where we show up first and get ourselves organized, make sure our equipment is working, and then ship everything out to the field camp from there. And our field camps for these campaigns, which we've done three of so far. So our camps for these campaigns are fairly large for a deep field camp. We're essentially across the Ross Ice Shelf from McMurdo Station, so it's a pretty long trip to get there. So when we move out to our deep field camps after we finish up our preparations in McMurdo, we generally have at least 20, maybe more than that, people in the field at any given time. So they're pretty large camps. And the reason that I say that, I guess, is to make the point that doing this science takes a lot of people. And it takes people at all levels in their scientific training. We have some people in charge who are very experienced scientists and who have been doing this for decades and have spent decades planning these field campaigns. And then we have students. We even, our first season, had an undergraduate in the field with us. We've had visiting scientists from other countries come for parts of our campaigns. So these things really are a big team effort. And I think that's one of the coolest parts about it, at least for me. I have some really great memories from our last field season, where everyone just worked together so well. And it just showed how, despite the fact that the work can be kind of stressful, because, for example, equipment is breaking all the time because it's cold and the equipment has been through a lot just to get to where it is. So things do not go smoothly. You're likely to not get as much sample as you would like. And you have interests that could be in competition with one another. Like, we need to get water samples, but we also need to get sediment samples. You only have one hole. You can't do those things at the same time. And if one of them goes wrong and an instrument gets stuck in the hole, then the next group can't get their samples. So it really takes people being willing to come together for a common goal to have a good outcome. And I think for me, that's one of the coolest things about working in Antarctica, because that's when the science works the best there. You have great teams of people.
Yeah, that sounds really good. It sounds like an amazing community that you would have working there. It almost reminds me of like these NASA missions that you hear about where, these scientists are working on collecting samples from Mars, and this group wants to take this and that group wants to take this, and you do have to compromise but also work together. Yeah, very interesting. How does the Antarctic trips compare to your most recent trip, which I believe was to the Alaskan Arctic? That you've only recently come back from, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So I returned from that trip about 3 weeks ago, just barely 3 weeks ago. And we spent 2 weeks in the Alaskan Arctic in Utqiagvik, which is the most northern community in the United States. So it's basically the farthest north that you can go in Alaska. And it's a really great place to work as well. It's less logistically intensive than planning a subglacial field expedition, but still takes a lot of effort and a lot of teamwork to make it come together. In that case, we were sampling thermokarst lakes. So these are shallow lakes along the Alaskan coastal plain. They're around 2 meters deep at maximum. And they, depending on their depth, they either freeze completely solid during the winter or freeze nearly solid during the winter. And in this case, we were sampling lakes that were frozen nearly to the bottom. So we were getting about 1.5 meters to 1.7 meters of ice, and then, 50 to 20 centimeters of water column underneath that. And so we're trying to understand how the microbes are surviving in that and how they maybe even control the environment around them.
Wow, that's a really nice comparison to the Antarctic deep subglacial lakes, I can imagine. So going back to your samples from this Antarctic mission, finding life in such remote and isolated environments is a really interesting development, and it must have been amazing to work on this project like that. What can studying these organisms tell us about these unique ecosystems?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. So, like I mentioned before, these ecosystems are pretty isolated. They do not receive any external inputs. Whereas you might, if you're familiar with subglacial lakes in the Arctic, for example, there are lakes that receive inputs from the top of the ice sheet during the summer. There's melt water that cascades down through the ice. So they have some physical connection to the outside environment. These Antarctic lakes don't have that. So their only interaction with anything outside of the environment is the ice that's directly above them, which at some point in history was in contact with the atmosphere, right? So they're very insulated from what's going on around them. That makes them a really good place to ask questions about how life changes when it's not influenced by things around it. So, how do organisms evolve? How do their genomes change? How do they respond to one another when there's nothing else there to influence them?
Yeah, it must be one of the most isolated ecosystems on the planet, surely. Really incredible to think of how many millennia have passed since anything influenced them. So, when looking at the ecology and cellular biology of other extremely isolated species, we have often learned a lot about how life is able to survive on the very edge. Do you predict that there will be a similar understanding gained from these organisms?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think the answer is yes. So because these systems are physically quite unique, I think that there's a ton that we can learn from these organisms. So they are surviving in very low nutrient and low energy conditions. And by low energy, I mean that most ecosystems get most of their energy from sunlight. Right. And that's even true if you go to the dark bottom of the ocean floor. They're still receiving some amount of, biomass that was formed by using the sun for energy. These ecosystems don't get anything from sunlight. They did have a marine influence in the early Holocene. So we're talking quite a while ago. There was a marine inundation of this portion of Antarctica. So there is some old organic matter down there from that. But otherwise, they're mainly surviving by getting energy from minerals. So they're using things like sulfate, different types of nitrogen. They're using methane that's maybe being produced more deeply in the sediments underneath Antarctica. And so bringing all of that together and understanding how they can persist over time is certainly going to give us insight into, understanding how organisms can survive in extreme conditions.
That's fascinating. There aren't that many ecosystems on the planet that receive basically no influence from the sun, but I guess this is one of them. That's really, really interesting. So we've talked a little bit about your Antarctic trip and your Alaskan Arctic trip, but what's next for your research, and is there anything on the horizon that you're looking forward to?
Yeah, so for the subglacial research, those campaigns take a very long time to plan. So we don't have immediate plans to return to a subglacial lake, but I will say that the lakes that I've been talking about today are under relatively thin parts of the ice sheet. And by relatively thin, I mean a kilometer or less. So it's still a lot of ice, but as far as a subglacial lake goes, they're fairly small lakes and they're under thinner ice. We're hoping that our next step is going to be visiting a larger, deeper lake under thicker ice. We think that the physical and chemical conditions in a larger lake in a different part of Antarctica will be quite different, and that we can learn more about how organisms are surviving in these places by kind of expanding our sampling regime.
Yeah, wow.
So we hope that that will be next. But like I said, it takes a long time to get those things off the ground. As far as what's next for me, we brought back a lot of really great ice samples and water and sediment samples from our trip to the Alaskan Arctic. So we're going to be analyzing those, looking at ways that microbes can control ice formation. We hopefully will have some exciting stuff coming out about that in the next year or so. And then my next field work is going to be heading to Greenland, where I'm going at the end of June. I am working as a mentor on a research experience for undergraduates trip. So I'll be taking undergraduate students to the field in Greenland, and we'll be sampling some lakes that are in kind of different stages of glacial influence. So some of them are heavily influenced by glacial melt. Some of them have been disconnected for some time. And we'll be taking some samples to try to understand the microbiology of those systems. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. Another exciting trip to look forward to. So I've really enjoyed our chat, Tristy, but one final question to leave the listeners with. Whilst you're on these polar expeditions, what aspect of everyday life is made most difficult by the isolation and, in particular, the weather?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the first answer that I will give is maybe not that exciting, and that it's I really miss fruit, like fresh fruit.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I can
It's really
imagine
hard
it's
to
all
get.
dried apricots and stuff like that if you have them.
It's the small things. It's fresh fruit. In some ways, it's an interesting dichotomy because you are very isolated, but at the same time, you are ex in extremely close quarters with your team, which is both a wonderful thing, but also can become draining, especially if you, like I, am an introvert. And if you're someone that needs that kind of personal space to recharge, that's something that you, it's hard to come by on these expeditions.
Yeah, I can't imagine you can go for a 20-minute walk around in
No.
the on the Ross Ice shelf or wherever it was that
No,
you're based.
it's hard to get away.
Yeah, well, I'm sure the data and the results and the interesting papers more than make up for those sacrifices.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an amazing opportunity, and I am extremely grateful for all of the opportunities that I have had.
Brilliant. Well, I've really enjoyed this talk, and I've also learned a lot. A lot of questions have come to mind that we just don't have time for. But thanks again for coming on. And yeah, it's been a pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you.
The Para Aqua podcast was funded by COST, the European Cooperation in Science and Technology, and is a product of the Para Aqua Action Group. If you are interested in joining an action group or just want to know more, please go to www.paraaqua-cost.eu or follow the link in the episode description. The podcast is produced by myself and Serena Rasconi, and the Science Communication Coordinator is Anna Gavrilovich. Once again, thanks for listening, and see you next time on the Para Aqua podcast.